see. But I, that's okay. I actually still don't see any button to turn it on, so. Okay, I can tell. I can hear myself. So I just wanted to remind ourselves, what are the instruments that exist in the world that have something to do with ethics, science, and gender? So I've put a few things together here. The Universal Declaration on Human Rights, created by the United Nations in 1948, which says that people have the right to the benefits of scientific knowledge without regard to many considerations, including gender. There's the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which came out of the Commission on the Status of Women in 1979. And as most of you probably know, the very first conference here, the World Conference of Science, that led to the fora, had recommendations on gender that were very instrumental in many organizations, including UNESCO, where I used to work. Then the Gender Advisory Board had 8 transformative actions, including one, which was addressing ethical issues in S&T, the gender dimension. That's from 2011. And then 2 years ago, UNESCO updated its recommendations on science and scientific researchers, and it has 10 action points, and all of them are relevant for gender equality. The reason that they made that transformation was because they had been collaborating with the SAGA project, the STEM and Gender Advancement Project of UNESCO. So at an earlier point in my life, I worked at the Institute for Philosophy and Public Policy on Environmental Ethics. So I looked at my old notes, and in my opinion, the ethical arguments that we can make are based around fairness, around justice, around equality, and about utilitarianism, but I call it here utility, and I'll just say a little bit about one or two of those later on. So as Dr. Morenzi pointed out, Gender Insight, which stands for Science, Innovation, Technology, and Engineering, is about the nexus between gender, science or sight, and development. The link between gender and science has a focus on science education, on the S&I system, and career advancement and scientific leadership, which is this book is about. The gender development link we heard a little bit about in plenary earlier, that men and women are affected differently by development, and so you need to use a gender lens in order to make sure that the abilities, the concerns of both men and women are taken into account, so things that you create are equally beneficial to both men and women. And that way you'll have more equitable, effective, and long-term development outcomes. And the science development link, I think that was made pretty strongly by Mohammed Hassan, that you can't achieve the SDGs if you don't have an STI basis for all of them, I would say. So for Gender Insight, its strategic goal is to increase the number of science policies and programs globally that take account of the gender dimension of science, leading to the full participation of women and men in science and the consideration of the differential impacts that development has on men and women so that we have equitable and sustainable development. And this in itself represents an ethical approach to assure that everyone benefits from and can contribute to science. And those two terms, that benefit from and can contribute to, come from at least two of the things I had in my second slide. So the book, Pathways to Success, Bringing a Gender Lens to the Scientific Leadership of Global Challenges, tries to bring in ways of addressing gender equality in science leadership by focusing on women who have actually made it to the top of global research programs. Its aim is to advance women's equal representation in science through the process of equity, both in terms of who does the research and leads the science and how the science is done. It was formally launched at UNESCO in March this year. The reason that that Gender Insight decided that such a publication was necessary was because we know about, you saw in Dr. Hassan's slide, the scissor effect of women dropping out after they get their PhD. The further on in careers you go, the fewer women there are. That's why it's called the scissor diagram. We know very much less about what leads to success for women to stay and make it to the top than we do about the multitude of barriers that they face. We also know that the application of science and the doing of science are both gendered, and it's the opinion of Gender Insight that the increasingly complex and globalized challenges that the world is facing require integrated global responses, a mix of different science types, and a diverse scientific leadership. And Gender Insight itself has several thematic areas: education in the workforce, agriculture and food security, water and sanitation, energy, climate change, and transport. So you see that it itself has a lot of focus on some of these global challenges. So the report brings a different perspective to what we talk about when we talk about gender in science. It recognizes the incredible amount of work that's already been done, but it looks at levels that are usually not explored. And there hadn't been a slide prepared, but if you look in the book, you'll see there's five levels here. At the bottom of the pyramid is individual scientists, how they do their own careers. Then you have the production of science at the institution level, the laboratory, the university, the professionalization of science going up to the national level, the global science coordination, which is international science organizations, and then what they call the multilateral organizations at the very top, the United Nations, but they have a big focus in this book on the European Union and suggest that other regional organizations could have a similar focus. And it looks at how difficult it is to institutionalize policies given the awareness of politics and power relations. And this is one of those areas where I think fairness is coming into play as an ethical issue. And it highlights how the five different levels, especially the bottom, the individual, and all of the ones above that are all institutional, they have to play together in order to make a change to have more women making it to the top in science. So the pathways, the reason they call the book this, was it's an approach that recognizes that men and women do not experience or advance in scientific careers in the same way, and that scientific systems and conventional understanding of what leadership is are not gender neutral. There are many different examples in the book about a typical male pattern and a typical female pattern, but showing that both of them don't hold water as representing the majority of either sex. And the dominant narrative about scientific leadership precludes addressing women's needs and roles. So we know that at the very top level, the European Union and the United Nations system and similar entities, that there have been a large number of different activities, and Roman Morenzi's already mentioned several of the ones you'll hear about today. But despite this, it's the contestation of gender insight that there's no clear signposting for individuals, institutions, or countries. It's hard to build on policies, to link up all these various activities, and find your way through them to find the thing that could be a best practice useful for you, your institution, your country. And there's no guarantee within any of these organizational settings that gender will remain a focus. It requires both formal and informal strategizing to make sure it stays on the agenda over time. So there are six key themes that come out at the level of the individual scientist. What they did with this book was do extensive interviews with a number of women and a few men scientists who are leading major global scientific research programs to find out what in your background enabled you to get there. So the very first one was a commitment to addressing a problem, and often for reasons such as, and these are quotes from the book, to drive the drive I had to use science in the service of humanity, or I wanted to do something about social justice. And that's where I think we have a strong argument that the utilitarian ethical dimension, which is I'm adopting from an ecological and environmental ethics, it plays a role here too. It seems to be something more strongly felt by women than by men. At least that's what I read over and over again, but I I'm not saying that I personally think that that's the truth. These women who made it to the top refused to give up in spite of people telling them, oh, you're a girl, you're not going to be any good at math, you can't do this, and feeling a lot of pressure from people to drop out. And there is where the fairness in ethics comes in. The fact that having mentors really was important for them, and they in turn are trying to be mentors to others, and the same as having had a role model, and a role model can be a man or a woman, and wanting to serve as one for future generations, learning how to develop the skills for leadership, building and leveraging the networks you create over your career, and then finally, when you're in a position of power, helping to reshape the organizational culture so it's more amenable to additional women coming in over time. So there are a number of recommendations coming out of the book. If you ask the question, what have been the main change agents that are pushing for increased gender equality in science, they suggest, and I won't read these, but to put together a list of all the things that do exist, target young scientists with initiatives that will help them, and where have policies come out and where have they stalled. In order to be able to answer that question, you need evidence to inform international science and policy. We need to ensure that policies exist at every level of international science, not just at the university or research laboratory level, but at every part of the scientific enterprise, and other speakers will address part of that. And we need to constantly advocate for, including through with resources, that gender equality continue to be something seen as important in science. What are the relationships between policy and behavior change and individual women's scientist pathway? Well, we need to design policies for international science itself, not for individuals or organizations, almost done, and ensure that all organizations do have policies that address these issues in a cross-referenced way, because it's not enough to only look at the individual women scientists or to look only at the policies of an organization or to include gender as a component of what is being undertaken in the research, but everything has to be connected in a multiple reinforcing fashion. So thank you for your attention. And I hope somebody else knows how to get out of it. There.
So thank you very much. Aldo, it's your time. I have known Aldo for more than a decade now. Yes. We have been meeting in South Africa, Japan, Germany, and
everywhere.
So, okay.
Thank you very much, Romain. Dear colleagues, good evening, and Romain, thank you for the introduction. We have indeed known each other for more than a decade, and it's my pleasure to be part of this panel and its esteemed participants. I'm Aldous Strubel. I'm the Executive Director for Strategic Partnerships at South Africa's National Research Foundation. We are the public funder to support research, human capital development, and infrastructure platforms. Many of you will have like organizations in your countries, and many countries may have multiples of these types of organizations. And I decided to make that clear because I speak from the context of a funder tonight. Albeit a national funder working internationally, especially with a very prominent Africa agenda, that is the type of role and power that public funders have in this very critical and fundamental topic that we are discussing in terms of ethics, gender, and research. Also want to say I speak for Professor Cruz, who's the president of the Sao Paulo Research Foundation, or FAPESP, and the current president or chairperson of the governing board of the Global Research Council, which I'll explain in a moment, and to just recognize the work that we will be presenting tonight, one of my colleagues at the National Research Foundation, Dorothy Ngila, and of course Roshni Aberdeen, who's a senior policy manager for internationalization at the UK's research and innovation. So colleagues, allow us to provide a few posits in this context of a public funding agency. And please, if you don't mind, contextualize that within your environment, your public funding for research in your own country, and what that could mean. So, publicly funded science granting councils play a significant role in availing funding to support both human capacity development in science and in research and innovation at research performing institutions. And therefore, they're an important change agent. And those research performing institutions, for the majority, universities, national facilities, national or international laboratories, are very much in line with what Anathea has just presented in terms of the type of impact and change one would like to see at that level of the researcher. You will know that many reports dedicate findings and recommendations geared towards research funding agencies in their different forms, whether it's national, regional, or international. Funders of research have a fundamental role to play in influencing and advocating for the development and adoption of policy actions and choices that address gender equality in research and innovation. And therefore, there is a catalytic role that they have in shaping and consolidating national systems and innovation, and collectively the global science system. That is the context to start, colleagues, and we thought that it is important to provide that framework because that is the type of power and influence that we are trying to use as an example. The second part of the talk is about the Global Research Council that many of you might be aware of. It is a virtual network established in 2012 consisting of funders of public research around the globe. It has had an illustrious development process with the 9th meeting that will take place next year. It consists of in excess of 80 public funders around the world with a combined funding envelope of almost $80 billion. That links directly to this positioning in the first set of remarks of that so-called power or influence that we as a collective could and can have. Every year, a number of topics are discussed and analyzed and agreed to in a consensus type of role, either for implementation or for direction at a global level of what specific areas of focus must be. We have seen over the past almost 10 years that members of the Global Research Council are increasingly aware of the gender imbalances in their research and innovation landscapes, and that they acknowledge that there is a role to play in redress. For example, we have seen, and there's good evidence to prove that many have gender policy statements and other policies in place, and that they also collect, analyze, and report either comprehensively or ad hocly, gender disaggregated data on gender balance in applications to funding schemes and success rates. In 2016, the GRC endorsed a statement of principles and 10 actions promoting the theme of that year, which was equality and status of women and research. And we used two overarching themes. One is the consideration and promotion of women in the research workforce. And the second is the integration of the gender dimension in research design and in the analysis of research outcomes. The GRC, and this is almost 80 public funders in the world, committed themselves to implement the following actions as most suitable and beneficial for their organizations, and perhaps more importantly, for their own national systems of innovation. These include engagement in national discussions of policy frameworks regarding equality, diversity, and the status of women, to collect and make available data, to incorporate the evaluation of progress towards gender-based goals, to shift the focus from the researcher track record to research opportunity, to provide training on equality and diversity policies, to explore pathways for women to succeed in research and to rise in leadership, to consider dedicated or strategic programs, to promote family-friendly policies and practices, to periodically review this principle and actions that I'm listing currently, and to recognize the advantages of considering the gender dimension in research and to encourage the development of this. Colleagues, I must share with you that this was a fundamental approach to get 80 heads of research councils in a common room and to share and agree on common principles when it comes to inclusion, equity, and equality of women in research. We have seen major shifts even in the short or 2 or 3 years since the adoption of those actions and the statement of principles. And many national public funding agencies are now actively promoting and implementing various strategies, policies, and actions to promote the status and equality of women in research. I'm also pleased to share with you the establishment of what we call the Gender Working Group, which is an action-orientated component to implement and to take further the statement of principles and necessary actions that are linked to the agreement by the members of the Global Research Council. This group consists of representatives from all five regions that comprises the GRC. And these are the Americas, Africa, Asia-Pacific, MENA, and others. The heads of research councils serve as champions of this work, and conversations of women in research are now entrenched in the GRC's annual and regional conversations, the latter which has enabled greater knowledge and practice sharing among the funding agencies. This book or booklet is not an academic contribution like the Book of Gender Insight or that Anathea has provided, but it is far-reaching and influential in the fact that it represents case studies from 28 countries and 53 different actions that have been compiled along the 10 actions of the statement that I have mentioned. There's also three very key and overarching findings from the analysis of this large number of case studies. Number one is that many funders are developing wider diversity goals that go beyond gender to include intersectionality. And we'll speak a little bit more about intersectionality during the session that Portia has put together tomorrow. And intersectionality refers to the interconnected nature of social categorizations, such as race, class, and gender, as they apply to a given individual or group. And they are regarded also as creating overlapping and interdependent systems of discrimination or disadvantage, or target other groups, such as indigenous groups, underrepresented ethnicities, and those who may have been disadvantaged socially, economically, or for health reasons. And I just need to add to this first finding or point, colleagues, is that we see diversity and equity as public funders, but also as this force that is the Global Research Council, much wider than only the discussion of discrimination in gender. The second one is that GRC members are increasingly looking at programs of large-scale institutional and culture change. By sharing the challenges faced in a shifting global, regional, and national framework of culture, GRC participant organizations can cultivate an atmosphere of mutual sharing and learning. And the third overarching finding is that the case studies include multiple examples of dedicated or strategic programs, such as advertising for female-only positions or the use of targets, quotas, and caps. I can speak from our own experience. Senior member Sarah Plowman is here from UKRI. I see Osamu Kobayashi is here from JST in Japan, and many others, which are forming strong, dedicated, truly global networks that has the notion that we are speaking of currently as one of the core items for discussion and dedication. We, as the NRF, engages with the largest program that L'Oréal offers on the continent, and Tanya might know about that, having been involved. We just had a discussion of the ISC's role, the International Science Council's role, in putting this at the core of our discussions. And I must say that they're working closer and closer during the past 3 years with the Global Research Council. And finally, a new study, which there is a call out for now, four case studies on the consideration of intersectionality in research, perspectives of public funding agencies, which has been commissioned by the Science Granting Council's initiative, a formal association of 15 science granting councils on the African continent, the South African chapter of OST, and the German Research Foundation, DFG. Colleagues, in conclusion, there are few women participating in STI, and established researchers and as decision makers. Often the conduct of STI does not consider the needs, abilities, capacities, and aspirations of men and women equally. And the business of policymaking for STI does not always adequately facilitate gender equality and equity in policy choices and their implementation, albeit at universities or research institutes or academies of science or government or at some funding agencies. There is no doubt that more need to be done in support of greater equality and equity in research and indeed by funding agencies. Within the ambit of the Global Research Council, the sense of urgency has certainly gained traction, and its participant organizations will continue to support, promote, and champion both conversations and especially actions in this regard. Thank you very much, Romain.
Definitely, the experience of South Africa over the last two decades and a half in diversity on the overall, including women, is very important. And the UNESCO, two global priorities are gender and Africa. Now I'm pleased to invite Dr. Tonya Blowers to come here. Tonya has been, when she arrived, she started at TWAS. We have only one person at OST. How many people do we have now?
11.
11. So we have a full program. We have two major, you know, that existed. The CIDA one existed, but we have the CIDA, the IDRC one. And Tonya did a PhD in women and gender. So people are trying to forget that, yeah. So let's just make sure that we know that she's an expert in gender in her own right. So please.
Not an expert in technology in my own right, though. Can't read the Hungarian, sorry.
Would you like to open this document?
Yeah, this one.
It's a bit slow, sorry.
So it's also a great pleasure for me to be here today and to hear the previous speakers as well. In fact, in some ways, the title of my talk could also be Pathways to Success. I've chosen to focus actually on four stories, four success stories from our programs. Trying to think about these stories both as individual success stories, but also within a whole network of very different support programs that they have picked up on and that OSD has participated in at some point along their journey. Just as a way of thinking about the kinds of challenges that women face in different countries and different regions and how they go about actually storming their way through to success, if you like. So I've chosen women from four different regions that we deal with, so from Africa, from Asia, from the Arab region, and from Latin America. We have funded programs for a very limited number of countries. They're mostly least developed countries. Now, you can imagine that while it's difficult for most of us in the developed world, the challenges that women from developing countries face are really quite extraordinary. And we'll look at some of those now as we go through. So this is my first colleague, I would like to call her. This is Tabasa Mumtaz from Dhaka in Bangladesh. And last year, Tabasa was awarded our prize that is funded by the Elsevier Foundation. It's a very modest prize. It's only $5,000, and it goes to five women every year. These five women must come from 66 eligible countries. Bangladesh, as I'm sure you know, is one of the poorest countries in the world. Also, one of the most polluted from my visit there, I can say. This is one of the most important things, ways that we can support women is by giving their scientific work visibility. So what I wanted to say as introduction of what OSD, the four ways in which OSD is really trying to support women, I would say that it's through developing a sense of community, allowing and enabling mobility, encouraging stability, and I'll explain what I mean by that, but it's mostly about how do you stay at home when your home does not have any of the resources that you need in order to carry out your research. And then the final key element is visibility. So here we have a very modest award, but there's quite a strategic part to this award, which is that the winners receive their award at the AAAS ceremony in the States. That's a huge annual conference. And they give a presentation on their work during that ceremony. And the knock-on effect of having that international audience and the knock-on effect at home as they're celebrated in their national newspapers is really huge. Quite often, our awardees are invited to have special interviews with presidents of their country. In this case, I think Tabasum receiving this award was a direct reason why she then went on to receive a major research grant to improve her laboratory back in Dakar. She actually got an OSD PhD fellowship from us way back in 2002. And the OSD PhD fellowship scheme is a south-to-south scheme. The idea of this is that you don't go and study in a developed country because, on the one hand, it is a kind of antidote to brain drain. If you go and study in the States, you may never come back. The fellowships would be much, much more expensive if we had to fund the scholarships in the North, so we could serve fewer women. But also, importantly, the culture shock can be much reduced. So, for example, we often have regional movements. So Tabasum comes from Bangladesh, and she went to study at the University Putri in Malaysia, where she did her PhD in 4 years. And then she carried on and did a postdoc there in Malaysia, at another university in Malaysia. And then she returned back to Bangladesh. And this is very typical of our scholarship program. We have many African women who will go and study in South Africa, specifically because the institutes in South Africa are exceptional. We have probably about 50% of all of our fellows go and study in South Africa, actually. So it's a very interesting movement, and there's kind of complementary knowledge that can be shared as well between these countries. And also the Host Institute itself, there is a work of capacity building that's going on as they accept these international students from Africa, from Asia, and then they have really good exchange of research techniques. So Tabassum is definitely someone we're very proud of and we wish to celebrate. Next one, I see Mohammed Hassan has just walked in and knows very well this young woman up here. This is Nashwa Issa from Khartoum in Sudan. And Nashwa has been with us for a very long time. She actually did her BSc in Khartoum in physics, and then she went to Sweden, to Linköping University, and got her master's there. And she picked up and got a PhD from OSD and went to study in South Africa at Nelson Mandela University. She has been really an extraordinary ambassador for OSD. She has founded the OSD national chapter in Sudan. OSD, we have a huge membership program. We have over 8,000 members. If there are more than 20 members in any country, the members can choose to set up a national chapter. A national chapter identifies the specific challenges that women face in that country, and they will choose what kinds of activities they need in order to support themselves. OSD doesn't give them any direct funding, but we can give them the backbone of an international framework, which can help them in getting their own funding. South Africa, the South African Academy of Science has been a huge support, for example, for many of OSD fellows who are in South Africa. I contacted Nashwa the other day just to check how she's doing. She said, "Oh, good to hear from you, Tonya. I've got a five-day-old baby." So that's very good to hear. And she also had a son while she was doing her PhD. She has been extraordinary. She just received an honorary degree back from that Swedish university where she did her master's for her services to supporting women in Khartoum. So it's a big circle. This is Pendo Bigame, who is from Tanzania in Africa, and I'm actually going to Tanzania straight from here next week, where we have a workshop for our early career fellows. And it's not a coincidence that Pendo is an early career fellow from Tanzania, and we're doing the workshop there. It's because Pendo and her two other awardees from Tanzania volunteered to host this regional workshop. So Pendo has received last year a very prestigious new award that we have, and this is the award, when I mentioned one of our aims was encouraging stability. So one of the, you all know about the scissors diagram, and you all know about the metaphor of the leaky pipeline. One place where women will drop out is at early career stage. And especially women from developing countries. Can you imagine? The typical trajectory is you must, by definition, leave your home country to get your PhD. There are not the resources in your country. If you can, you stay longer and you get your postdoc, because there aren't the resources to do a postdoc in your home country. Many, many women scientists actually want to return home, but they dread coming back and losing all of that wonderful contact, that embeddedness, the research environment that they had, and all of those resources. But still, they do come back. And we would like to support as many of them as we can in that decision. And so we've created this wonderful fellowship with the Canadian Research Centre, International Development Research Centre, $50,000 for 2 years to a woman. And so Pendo has received that grant. She will work with her institute to create an environment where international visitors will want to come to her university in Dar es Salaam. They will build up a laboratory. They're making links with industry. Pendo works on recycling of textile waste through nanotechnology. She's an engineer. In fact, the women that I chose are also in STEM fields that are very underrepresented, typically, for women. Pendo also established OSD National Chapter in Tanzania, and the OSD National Chapter is hosting the workshop that we're running next week for the early career fellows. So you can see how these things are really proliferating. And just my final example, I love this photo. This is our vice president from Uruguay, Hannah Rodriguez Hetz, who is a mathematician doing dynamical systems. She looks very small there, but she's had a huge, huge impact on our organization. She was the first woman in Uruguay to do a PhD, any PhD, and the first woman to become a professor in mathematics. Sadly, she is still the only female professor in Uruguay. Currently, though, she's based in China, doing her research there. Hannah, just to let you know the importance of the social media, Hannah has got over 15,000 Twitter followers, 5,000 Facebook followers. She does a lot of work on radio and television. She has a wonderful program called Hannah and Her Sisters, for those of you who know the film, where she talks about women scientists. So I just wanted to give you some examples, really, of the different journeys that women take, the different places that they come from, and all of the different organizations that pull in to support at different times, and how OAS is also managing to find different ways and different places to keep supporting them. I'll just flick through to my final slide so you have our contact details. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know if my eyes are still good. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I've been introduced before. My name is Mukhtar Davo. I'm the director of Science, Technology, and Innovation in the Ministry of Higher Education, Research, Science, and Technology of the Gambia. C'est bon? Okay. I'll be sharing with you our experiences with the STEM and Gender Advancement Project implemented by UNESCO in 2018. Before I go into the presentation, I would like to share with you that in my country, we are observing the National Science Week this week. And today, we are recognizing the role and participation of female scientists. We call them the female science, the science heroines. We recognize and reward their immense contributions to science in the Gambia. Saga was a. Is this the? I don't think this is my presentation. No. Sorry, excuse me. Give me a minute, let me work on the actual presentation. It seems the one I saved on the machine is different from the actual presentation. I'll use technology, just give me it's strange how it happens. I'll just transfer it here and that's better. But not quite. Oh, it's about just 8 minutes. It's usually, I do presentations in different places, so sometimes I just need to transfer it to the machine. I think there's I can still use this other presentation. it's taking time. Sorry for the inconvenience. Okay, where is the lady again? Yeah, can you open that one?
Yes, this one?
Yeah, open it. Okay. So I would be skipping some of the it has all the information. I just had to reorganize it. Our coming into SAGA started with a training program, a capacity building program, where we have experts from UNESCO coming into the Gambia to give us a hands-on experience with the various SAGA tools in play. Some of the major findings with regards to SAGA, this is the gender objectives footprint. This shows the country's performance with regards to some of these footprints. You can see from there are seven gender objectives lists, and we tend to be doing very well with objective 1 and 2 and partly 7, but the rest of it, there are challenges. Now, in terms of our findings, we realize that at the level of the secondary schools, we have been able to achieve gender parity with regards to STEM enrollments. We have equal number of boys, almost equal number of boys and girls in the STEM, but embarrassingly, we have fewer female STEM teachers, which we don't have enough role models to encourage the young ones to venture into the STEM. If we look at it from a broader spectrum, at least there is parity at level 3, which is the secondary level. So at the post-secondary tertiary level, post-secondary non-tertiary, it drops down to 26, and tertiary level, it drops down to 9% female enrollment in the STEMs. At bachelor's, it goes up, and master's, PhD, it comes down. Currently in the Gambia, we have 32% of females, of researchers are females. That is when you combine both the public and the private sector. These are some of the instruments that are being used by the ministry to encourage the participation of women in STEM. And one of them is the scholarship program. In 2017, 29% of the applicants that applied in the sciences were female. And 34% of them have been awarded. So some of the impact of the implementation of, I'll take them both, Gospin and Saga, because they talk almost about similar things. It's just that Saga goes more about gender equality in the sciences. But both activities, project activities, made strong recommendations for the development of a national STI promotion law. Already a legal advisory panel has been set up with members from the various government sectors to advise on the best way forward to make sure that there is a legal and a regulatory environment to support the participation of women in STEM. We also have technical advisory committees and an expert working group to make sure on STEM education, to make sure that STEM education is given the much required gender lens. And also, because of the implementation of these projects, some of these are some of the major recommendations that are currently being pursued. One of them is to establish an R&D human capital development program with special emphasis on women, creation of a national innovation fund, and the list goes on. One of the major achievements, however, is the establishment of the gender unit. Since the ministry's establishment for the last 12 years, gender has been a very silent issue until the coming of the Saga project that the ministry deemed it necessary to establish this unit. And it was going to be functional by next year, 2020. There is a budget support from the government to make sure that activities of this unit are being properly implemented. So basically, I'm disappointed. My presentation disappeared, which was much, much detailed than this. But basically, what I wanted to add is that the gender, the Saga project only touched on the, was just more like a scratch on the surface, the problems and the challenges in ensuring gender equality in STI are very huge, and I think a word of encouragement for all of us to take it as a responsibility to critically look in more details into the reasons why sometimes men are dominating in the sciences. Some of them might be cultural. In our case, for example, we tend to have gender biases towards women in a lot of areas, and science is one of them that is seen as a difficult area, generally. But it seems to be taken as something that is not for women, and I don't think that should be the case. In the Gambia, that is why we are now identifying and recognizing and rewarding our female science heroines. But also in the developing world, there is a huge capacity gap. For example, in the Gambia, in the public sector, for instance, most of the researchers are male, predominantly male. It's only in the private sector that you have a huge number of female researchers. But also the environment to encourage women into research. Even for those who have studied sciences to become researchers, the environment is not there to support. I think we need to work on that environment so that more women are encouraged to take up careers in science. Otherwise, we lose all of them to the banks and to other non-science establishments. I thank you all for your kind attention. Thank you.
So I'll ask the speakers to come in front. And so we could circulate a mic if there is any questions. We have about 23 minutes. So, are there microphones? Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Anupama, and I am from Bangladesh. It was nice to see Tabassum up there. I'm really happy. But yes, we are one of the poorest countries and also one of the most polluted cities. But I would like to point out that we're also one of the most resilient people in the world. My question regarding gender inequality is focused on the policies that we currently have or we currently face when we are applying for international funding as females. But first, let me ask a question to the whole of the audience. Do we agree with these two comments or sayings? Age is just a number. Do we agree? Okay, maybe not. Motherhood is the hardest job in the world. Do we agree there? Yet, when we try to apply for international funding, a lot of funding agencies set up an age limit. And also, if a person stops at the middle of an academic career to get married, have a baby, and raise family, somehow it is seen upon as she was not maybe smart enough to stay in academia, therefore went to the other options. Also, if you have a gap like that in your academic career, sometimes it becomes difficult to apply or win a funding from an international agency. So my question is directed to the funding agency representatives. Why? Why this age limit? And why can't we stop our career to raise a family and then come back? Because surely our brain does not dumb down when we become mothers.
Thank you very much. So we'll take around the question so that if there is any question, we would like to take it, and then they will respond. Any other question at this time? Comment? Yes, please.
Hello, everyone. My name is Kaiser Nawab, and I'm representing Commission on Science and Technology for Sustainable Development in the South, COMSATS. This session was really particularly important and interesting for me because I work for the gender minorities in Pakistan when I was the chairman of the National Youth Parliament, Pakistan. And we formulated some policies, suggested some policies towards the transgenders, the LGBT community, and it was just previously passed unanimously from both the houses of the parliament and with the protection of rights of transgender bill, which covers the education and the other sectors. While listening to the speakers in the panelists, I didn't hear anything about the gender minorities like LGBTs. That was focusing mostly on women and men, which are almost, I think, equally, and we have achieved a lot in the global north and even in the south as well. So what do you think that is there any opportunities for them? Is there any opportunities to become, to make some policies for them, to involve them in STI? Like recently there was one transgender from MIT who got something in the physics. I'm not like scientist, but that is what I believe, that the other genders can be more effectively give some innovations. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The question is for everybody in the panel.
Thank you very much. So, for the questions related, for example, to the issue of age limit, and can I throw it to Aldo? He's the National Research Foundation is a funding agency, and probably also to the ministry, the person from the Ministry of Education. Yeah. Aldo.
Romain, thank you. And Madam, let's start with the easy questions tonight, is it not? It is a fundamental question that you ask. And I think there is a realization and some proof that there has been significant movement to see a whole-of-career approach in the funding modalities that many of the agencies are applying. So if one thinks of a career pathway, it is usually in funder or science speak, early career or emerging, then more established, and so on. That is the normal way that career pathing is usually described. But we have seen, and many studies have shown that, and I'm very happy to indicate that many of the funding agencies, including my own, see it as much more of a collective now. So it is not in the usual stratification mode of who you fund when. There's a flip side, and let me be very frank, and you might take this... In a very serious way. One must keep in mind that there is also a productivity limit or level in terms of contribution of to science whenever one is in a certain career pathway. So expecting a 50-year-old person to contribute from a competitiveness point of view now to the world of science in a limited framework, limited funding, where there's a lot of competition for resourcing, that frankly is one of the reasons why it is sometimes not so easy to take a generalist approach to this notion of non-normative career pathing. The other part is that, may I be very direct, you speak as if it's only the woman's responsibility to look after a family or to have that career component within personal and academic environments. And for many people and in many constructs, it is the case. But there is also a little bit of a renewal or innovation that must be brought when one speaks of a whole of family approach in a whole of career pathing type of approach, that there must be insight with modalities that not just pins this on the one person. Now, one can argue or theorize from many perspectives for this challenge that exists. But it is something that not enough work or insight has been dedicated to. It is certainly something that needs much, much more innovation towards an insightful process of seeing a whole of career as opposed to only the normative areas of development. So you might not be having a lot of satisfaction with this type of response. And it will be interesting to hear what the senior representatives from the other funding agencies who are here has to say. But as we have spoken about the Global Research Council, many of the heads of these 80-plus funding agencies around the world that struggled and contend with exactly this challenge that you have posited in front of everyone, I cannot agree more that it's something that needs more maturity for us to take further. While I have the microphone, I cannot support more your indication of looking at other types of genders in our discussion of what diversity is. We have a normative of seeing men and women and describing that as gender. Tomorrow, when we speak of intersectionality, or I will, in the Porsche session by Elizabeth, that is something that must be raised, and especially, let me be direct, in many cultures where this idea of difference or the non-usual gender identity of male and female is not accepted and where it is not public. It is perhaps not something that can or should be very specific in competitive funding, but it is something to consider in terms of inclusivity, diversity, and competitiveness based on excellence without any inhibition of who applies or from what point of view.
Thank you very much, Aldo. Anathea, you have been at UNESCO for many years, and now you are retired, but you have contributed a lot to this issue. Anathea and I served at UNESCO for 1 year as the Director for Science Policy and Capacity Building, and SAGA and Gospin were under me. I can say that in terms of so we work together a lot. So can you comment on that? I also to comment on this issue of age limit, and also Tony, I'd like you to do a comment on that.
Okay. Well, if you would like me to start with the question about age and funding. Tanya and I were both at a conference in Trieste a couple weeks ago for the final meeting of a project funded by the International Science Council, where there was over 100 people there, and there was great consensus in the room on precisely this topic, that career breaks, there need to be reintroduction to the funding stream, and that age shouldn't be an absolute priority. But the person who had joined us from the European Research Council, a person who's within the French system but representing Europe, said, you also have to look at it as our job is to create career pathways for scientists, so we have to have early career and mid-career and late career kinds of funding opportunities. But he took home the message, we also need something else. So it seemed like he was going to be taking that message back to Brussels. So I'm hopeful, especially since Pathways to Success says that the European Union is really advanced in everything it's doing on gender equality in science. If any institution can make this happen, I think they can. And referring to the question from Pakistan on other genders, I was involved in the SAGA project from the very beginning. I'm not here to talk about it today, but I will say that we have two surveys for SAGA. One is of science, technology, and innovation policies for member states, and another survey on drivers and barriers to careers in science and engineering. And in both of those surveys, we do give the option of people can respond other than male or female, or men or women. But since we know that our surveys were going to be used at a national level, and that in some countries that in itself could be a problem because it's against the law or things like this, we left great flexibility to the national SAGA teams to decide exactly how they want their survey. We gave a template, and they could pick from it for what's appropriate for their country. But we wanted to be able to make that data available, and I was a bit disappointed that the International Science Council survey, which was based on the SAGA survey, decided only to look at men and women. they just took that question out, and they reached 32,000 people who contributed to that survey. So it was a lost opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So on this issue of career path, we need some innovation. We need some new innovations. They say early career, mid career, whatever. We need some way to find a way to innovate, to find a way actually to take into account this the pathway. For example, if you look at in Sweden, for example, in Sweden you have parental leave, men and women. So if you are a young couple, we have a baby, it's not up to the woman just to leave the career and let the man go away. And then the woman comes back at 40 when the child is in start school. Yeah, they have to share. You do 1 year, I do 1 year. Or you do 6 months, I do 6 months. So this is how it works. So I think that national policies are very important in taking into account. This is why, for example, Maktar talked about the issue of legal issues. They need to have a legal instrument that make sure that take into account that when at the age of 30 you have a couple, you start your family, why do they want to let the men continue and the woman stays at home? So this is a human right issue. This is a legal issue. Those things have to be taken into account. So, and also at the national level, in some countries, most of the farmers, actually the farming actually is done by women. This means actually women contribute probably to more than 50% of the tax money. So, and then you realize that they don't have the benefit of societal educational component, which is, and then we go to science and technology and the other things, yeah. Etonia, could you? If you could probably, yeah, you wanted to comment on the issue of Yeah.
I think the issue of transgender is, for me, brings up lots of issues. One thing I would say is that ideally we wouldn't need an organization for women in science. You know, I mean, ideally any application would be considered on its merits, and your different diversities and different perspectives that you bring to your project would be seen as a compliment, as being part of the excellence that you bring. I find the distinctions and the categories, I'm very uncomfortable in general with those. At the same time, I'm so happy to be part of this organization because at this moment in time, we need that kind of counteractive activity, but I don't believe that's the future, I suppose. I see it as a temporary necessity. In terms of age limits, this is interesting what Aldo was saying about, you know, when you're 50, oh dear, you can't make the same kind of contribution. And it's not just that, though. I suppose in some sense, because it's a funding model, you do think about investment. You do think about what you can pass on. You think about how many years you can be productive. It's quite a vicious way to think, but it's a kind of funding model in a sense. We've tried to moderate this by thinking more in terms of how many years since you got your PhD, for example, if it's a advanced research grant. And there does seem to be an importance that it wasn't 20 years ago that you got your PhD, for example, because then you're not in the loop, you're not doing, you know, relevant research. So what would be the maximum amount of time that you last did engaged research in order to apply for a grant? I think those are questions that are more important than how old are you. Third point I would make just briefly about childcare. I've been very interested with all the different countries that I visit, privileged to visit as part of my job, to notice that we talk about childcare. We know that fathers can help out. We know that that's, you know, it's not the same in every country. But what we tend to forget, I think, is that childcare also manifests in very different ways in different countries. So, for example, in many countries in Africa, you have free childcare with extended families. So the issue is not when you're at home, how do you do your PhD? It's how do you leave home and do your PhD? When you leave home, can you bring your partner with you? Can you bring your auntie with you? Can you bring five people with you that you would have at home? No, you can't. then what becomes important instead would be to have a free mobile phone so that you can continually Skype the auntie. And, you know, there's lots of different issues going on. So I think that that's also something that's very under discussed. You know, what are the different kinds of childcare modalities that there are in different countries, and how can we support them and make them available both to men and to women?
Thank you very much. Mokhtar, vous voulez dire quelque chose?
Yes, it's a very interesting discussion. And I think I'm learning a lot from here, but I'll just like to share experiences. It's a very big world that so many things can be happening, so many different things. We, with regards to funding, we do not have, we don't discriminate based on gender or what do you call it, all these things. Gender or age or level of career, whether you are starting or you are in the mid career or in the late career. In our case, the most important aspect is your research proposal must be in line with national development objectives, period. So whether you are 70 or whether you have 5-6 children, it doesn't matter. And it's also law that in the public sector, when a female researcher or any other public sector employee, females are subject to 6 months paid leave after giving birth to a new baby. And when we did the drivers and barriers, it was not. That particular policy was a driver because their colleagues in the private sector don't have it. But insofar, the laws could only cover for people participating in the public sector. With regards to the gender issues, mainly in the Gambia, it's mainly you're either male or female. We haven't had those gender discrimination issues as of now. But since we are doing laws and regulations for the future, it's good that these discussions are coming up so that we can have them as, we can put it at the back of our minds that these things might become an issue at some point in time. So we'll factor them into the laws and the regulations to promote gender equality in STI. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So we have only one question. Three. Okay. Just try to keep a question.
I wanted to start off. Let me introduce myself. My name's Kathy Whaler. I'm actually the president of the International Union of Geodesy and Geophysics. And as an aside, I'm the first female president in its 100 years history. But I wanted to make a comment on the age business. So I've encouraged, when I've been coming up through the association as vice president and things, when we don't actually fund grants and things, but we do make awards, you know, early career scientist awards, gold medals, this kind of thing. And I've been encouraging not just time since PhD, but full-time equivalent time since PhD. So if somebody comes back part-time, then we factor that in to the age limit. Okay. So it's not a strict age limit, but it's your scientific age. And I think this can be a useful way of judging those kind of things. Although I do take the point that if you've been out of science for an awful long time, then you need some means to get back in to be a productive researcher. And certainly in the UK, there are specific schemes that enable women to do that. Well, not just women, actually. Anybody who's been out of the workforce for a while, there are specific schemes. And those do then go on to generate people who are successful in getting research funding in their own right later.
Thank you very much. Definitely, I'm sure Tonya would like to meet with you. She could be able to meet some of our fellows. The other person have a question? And then the last one, very quickly.
I'm a professor of medical physics at University College London, and benefited from working part-time for 18 years and being told I wouldn't make professor part-time, but did. I also run a project in the Gambia, actually, so I'm really interested to talk to Mukhtar, and run a small charity to support African science students. So my question is, the initiatives that you're running, are you seeing an impact on increasing the number of women and girls coming into science at pre-university level in the way that they're able to see a pathway that's realistic for them to follow? Because obviously this is an issue that, you know, it's not just a leaky pipeline, it's the off-putting, downstream effect of blocking women and girls coming into science in the first place.
Thank you.
Ula.
Okay. Does this work?
Yeah. Yes, please, go ahead.
My name is Jennifer Plowell. I represent the Global Young Academy office based in Germany. And thank you for your presentations. It was nice to learn about these programs. And I appreciated that you highlighted one of Tanya, visibility, sort of for personal motivation of the scientists themselves, but also for the role model aspect. And just one example in our, which is fairly prominent, for example, that I recently came across is in a Wikipedia, for example, 16% of prominent people are women, represented on a platform that we all search on very often, and this is in part because 17% of the editors are women. So how can organizations like yours and science organizations work to increase visibility of female role models in science? And a related question,
I didn't capture the question.
The question was, how can organizations like yours and science organizations and maybe all of us work to increase the visibility of female scientists, female mm-hmm. researchers, mm-hmm. and also maybe you could say something about the role of mentorship in supporting female scientists along this career path that you were talking about.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, I would like to give 2 minutes to each of you, which make it, we will go more, okay? So I'll start with Anatea, and then go two minutes.
I already forgot what the question was.
just pick one of the questions and
Can you just repeat the first part of your question again? Okay, visibility. First of all, at UNESCO, you probably know about the International Day of Women and Girls in Science, February 11, was created in 2015 by the United Nations General Assembly. All of the organizations that are involved on up there all do something to try and bring in school children to learn from scientists at the various offices of UNESCO or the regional offices of ISC, et cetera. You are probably aware of the L'Oréal for Women in Science partnership and the OST Elsevier Award. So there are a lot of things that UNESCO does to try and make women visible in science. This year is the International Year of the Periodic Table, and when that was being voted, some of us said, well, why don't we also try to focus on women in chemistry this year? And there's actually 2 books that came out this year about women in chemistry that were linked with the discovery of a chemical element. There are other books that have been coming out on women in mathematics and things like this. So there's really a pretty large effort at many different levels to try to increase visibility. As for mentoring, there are a lot of interesting things that I've run across since I've retired from UNESCO at university level and at research institution level of mentoring programs that come up through the graduate students themselves. I belong to 500 Women Scientists, for example, which has organizations in countries all around the world of trying to get all the women who work in science in a town or a region to get together and talk and learn what their problems are, give mm-hmm. talks. I've given talks when I was still in Paris to graduate students there, trying to make the links together. So I do see a lot happening, but you need an entry point to know where to start looking.
Mm-hmm. Tanya?
Mm-hmm. Just trying to briefly say something to each of you. There is a wonderful new Indian grant to enable women to go back after they've had a long break, postdoc level, which is, I think it's the only one of its kind, actually, unless in the UK there are ones that I don't know about. But that seems to be really, really a positive move. Your question, for me, is really about how do you measure impact? And it's so difficult to do that. So what I presented today was these individual stories and the impact on their lives. At the moment, it's very difficult for us to really pull apart the ripple effect that their lives have on other people's lives. And we start to gather that information, for example, by saying, how many PhD students do you have? How many master's students? We get those kinds of numbers. But it still doesn't really reflect, you know, how many young girls' attitudes did you change, or how many young boys' attitudes. It's really difficult. And we are thinking a lot about how to do that, because that does seem to be very, very important. Even when we take our fellowships, I realize now when I present, there's other work I need to do in order to give a really good presentation, which would be for each of those examples. I would need the whole context, you know, what difference, how does that woman's story look different from the other woman's story in that country, for example? Or what I'd love to do, something I want to work on, the scissors diagram, which I use all the time because I think it's so neat. I'd love to show a trajectory of OSD fellowships that disturb that diagram, you know, in different countries. Is that something that we can show? We're only a drop in the ocean. I think we're making an impact. I think our national chapters are really making a huge impact at that local level. And that just tying up with this, your question, I think there's a tension between the big, flashy international award, which UNESCO does very well, the L'Oréal Awards. We also, in our way, our Elsevier Awards, we take them to the States, you know, it's a big, flashy award. But there are issues there, not least visa issues. One of our awardees this year won't be able to go. She's from Yemen. She can't get a visa. Last year we had somebody from Sudan couldn't go. So it's not fantastic. And actually, where do they need to be visible? For their careers, yes, it's very helpful to go to the States. But for other women in Yemen, is it? And perhaps having an award, a regional award, or an award at university is what I want to do. If any funders are out there would like to give us prizes at university level for women who have done the best science in their university, think how many people, how many women that impacts at that point. So I think visibility can also be very strategic, and it doesn't have to be big and flashy.
Mm-hmm. It can also be an opportunity for fundraising. What Donia has been trying to do, and Atiya to us, is to tell the story of the scientist, of these people who are receiving the research grant or receiving the fellowship grant. After the person has done a PhD, returns back home, how is she doing? You know, the tracer study, you follow up on the person, and you put in a human face, not just the PhD, just the publications, the human face. The person is teaching, you know. For example, the mathematician woman that you showed there, dynamical system is complicated. It's not just any mathematics, you know. It's really complicated. Math is complicated, but dynamical system is already complicated. And this woman is in her hometown, and she's making a difference. So telling the story is important in that. So visibility is important, and communication is important. Yeah, so the point is that. Hello.
Alex, thank you for your comments. I want to start with Tanya's last point and the question that was asked from the audience. One easily sometimes speaks about the funder as the be-all and end-all, and that organization must decide or must influence. Yes, there's a great expectation from that. But there's also other responsibilities. In our case, for instance, we have the national mandate for science advancement. And that creates a much bigger framework than just the competitive research funding environment. We reach in excess of 1.5 million learners every year from pre-primary right through to university entrance. And that, as was the question, tries to establish the demand side, the supply side, if you will, with the necessary tracking, but also to link to this notion of career pathing. Mm. But to be very direct, there's also a major role that the research institutions themselves must and should play. From older literature, it was always called the returnee problem. If you'll recall, the USAID investment in agriculture in the world, taking PhDs, postdocs abroad, and that when that person returns to their institution, there's no funding, there's no mechanism, there's not even a recognition of the advancement of the career, never mind refolding that person into the institution. Mm. And in our modern day and age, that is unfortunately very much still the reality. Mm. So it is not only the funder's responsibility, it's also the university or the research infrastructure or the recognition or that support mechanism that cuts across many of the aspects that we have discussed today. There's many examples that we have, as many other countries have, a National Women in Science Award, for instance. There's the Africa Women in Science Award in the country, etc.
The heroines of science in Gambia.
I love that. But it also recognizes the balance of contribution. And of course, it focuses on women awardees, but it brings notions of diversity, inclusivity, and of course this research construct almost, if you will, around the person apart from the awardee that has been awarded. So there's many examples, colleagues. We will stay critical because it's not working effectively. But I think we must admit that there's great strides that have been taken in a few very short years by science granting councils, by other magnificent programs, by ministries themselves, etc., to try and address these challenges.
Thank you very much. Makhtar, closing remarks, 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Very interesting questions coming from the audience. I think the impact of our engagement with government and with society is very huge. It would be a culmination of all our efforts over the last decade or so. The impact is huge. Initially, you know, in my country, for instance, we don't even talk about science and technology a lot. If you talk about science, the good examples would have been doctors, nurses. And thanks probably to MRC that has been doing a lot of work. But not very long when people begin to even realize the work of MRC. It was just seen perhaps as a clinic because they operate a clinic and people go to this place. But over the last 10 years, there's been vigorous effort to improve science in the country, the role and participation, not gender per se, gender that was only of recent when Saga came in. So right now what we have is that the government has taken bold steps to take funding of science and technology very seriously. There is going to be a University of Science, Engineering and Technology. Approval has already been granted for this university to be established, just to train scientists, engineers and technologists. Saga, we have a wholesale approach to generating and sustaining interest in the sciences, whether male or female. It's with the arrival of the Saga project that we started paying attention to the role of women and gender equality issues. Then we started looking into everywhere and realized that, yes, this is definitely an issue that we have not been taking note of, you know, over the years. And now is the time for us to take it seriously. So the impact of implementing the Saga tools was almost immediate. But the actions that we will take to realize the outcomes or the objectives of Saga will take a little longer than the next few years. So once we have the laws and everything, all the conditions necessary to encourage gender equality in STI or in STEM are in place, I'm sure that the impact will be felt even in your home in England. My dear friend, that basically, we hope in the next few years, once we have all these laws and regulations in place, and there is equality also amongst career professionals in the sciences and in the non-sciences, because that's also an issue. Sometimes in our part of the world, a lot of attention is not being given to the scientific civil service. We tend to be managed most often by people that are not coming from a science background and don't really see or appreciate the value or relevance of science in economic and social progress. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Tonya, you said you wanted to say something?
I just wanted to comment on the connections that get made. And I was at a panel earlier on the SDGs, and the notion that, you know, everybody needs to talk to each other, and that this World Science Forum should be a multi-stakeholder. But I think the evidence is that that's already the case. Mm-hmm. I think many of us are all working together. I mean, for example, the UNESCO SAGA project was undertaken in Sudan by the OAST National Chapter in Sudan, for example, and that was a wonderful, mm-hmm. wonderful connection. With the national academies, there's so much overlap. There's so much work that we all do together, and perhaps we're not very good at actually celebrating that so much. And I mean, I love that kind of direct line from the SAGA project to the ministry, to the University of STI in the Gambia. I think that that's, you know, pretty direct and a mm-hmm. huge impact. I think that those stories, perhaps we should be bringing here and saying, look what we have managed to do and the connections that we've made.
So I would like really to thank the audience for having stayed this long. So we heard from Gender Insight, which really for it's an initiative for policy, to have policy document to move forward. It's not really an organization. And then we heard from an organization, Women in Science for the Developing World. But OWSD is a global organization. At the same time, in terms of administration, is under UNESCO. So we are working under the second global priority of UNESCO, in particular as it relates to science and technology. And we heard from a national research funding agency in the most advanced science a country on the continent, and that was very important. But also we heard from a ministry of higher education, I think science and technology, in a very poor country, Gambia, that is struggling, that considers this is very important. But we have to just to understand that women constitute more than 50% of the world. And in most part of the world, women will spend most of the time with the children, will hang around, will be around the children. So science literacy for women is very important. So the more women we have trained in science technology, the more male in the developing world will be able to train. So for me, I believe that the gap we have in science technology in least developed countries, in the developing world, that gap actually, in terms of capacity building, can be overcome through a massive investment in STEM education for women. As Mohamed Hassan showed for the data from the National Science Foundation and other data, you could see really that there's still a challenge. You can see that only 20 countries, probably 30 countries, they share more than 80% of the global research output. And the other countries, and you saw Africa, we are still challenging. And by just supporting men, very few men will not be able to make us achieve that. By putting more women at the center of the education, STEM education, STEM development, STEM workforce, will be able to I think, to achieve very quickly or to advance very quickly into actually bringing everybody together. Don't, it's not just about gender equality or just it's a hell here, it's another gender issue for science, technology, less women. No. It is even for our generation, the women, the men, to have more men going into science and in the developing world, we will need more women in that sense. So in that sense, then I would like just to close here, and I would like to ask the audience to thank our speakers again.